Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is February 16th, 2017. Now, I nearly always include a Leonardo da Vinci quote in all of my public speaking events. So I've used this twice just in this past week. And that quote is, learn how to see. Realize that everything connects to everything else. And I use that quote because to me it's true. There is nothing that does not connect to everything once you dig far enough. Yet, we live in a nearly context-free world where the Western media usually presents things as if they just emerged out of nowhere or are unconnected to anything else. Worse, our major institutions still operate as if they were independent and autonomous silos. Monetary policy conducted without regard for the biosphere. We're going to have infinite exponential growth come hell or high water. Energy policy without any sense of limits, and so on. Well, given all that, I could not be more excited for today's podcast guest. I am often asked who I read, which blogs, which authors, etc. Well, let me tell you that today's guest is one of the very few sources that I read religiously. Every article. Everyone. Why? Because he can connect dots and understand the interconnectedness of things like, the economy, energy, and the environment. Dr. Nafiz Ahmed is an award-winning 15-year investigative journalist, noted international security scholar, a best-selling author, and filmmaker. He tracks the war on terror in the context of what he calls the crisis of civilization. Now, that's a concept I know people here are already familiar with. He is international editor at The Canary, System Shift columnist at Vice's Science Magazine Motherboard, weekly columnist at Middle East Eye, and the creator of InSurge Intelligence, a crowdfunded public interest investigative journalism project, which you can find at patreon.com/Nafiz. That's patreon.com/NAFEEZ. Previously, Nafiz wrote The Guardian's Earth Insight blog, which is where I first became aware of him. And that was between April of 2013 and July of 2014. And in 2015, Nafiz won the Project Censored Award for Outstanding Investigative Journalism for his Guardian story on the energy politics of the Ukraine crisis. Now imagine that, connecting energy to politics and policy. How refreshing. And he's got a new book out. It's a very exciting book. It's entitled Failing States, Collapsing Systems, Biophysical Triggers of Political Violence. As I said, it's dot connecting and at its finest. Welcome, Nafiz.
Thanks so much for that intro, Chris. Really appreciate it.
Well, Nafiz, I'm already worried about how we're going to run out of time today because there's so much to discuss with you. So let's start here. I was just last week giving a talk at NASA. They're doing it's a 100-year anniversary, and they're looking forward 100 years. These are rocket scientists, literal. I'm talking with people at this blue sky planning session. They've driven Mars rovers around. They plan moonshots and missions to Titan, all that. And when I get up there and I go, here's a chart that shows energy in the economy. It's a straight line, tight connection. Here's a chart of where we are in the energy story. Ergo, let's go to dot three. I see big difficulty in having an exponentially expanding economy function in the future because we can't depend on, we've come through a very weird period in human history known as the last 60 years where we were exponentially expanding our extraction of fossil fuels. I have to tell you, Nafiz, even with this crowd, about half of them end up tipping their head sideways, looking like a dog listening to white noise, just like it doesn't compute. The other half get it, and they get very, very concerned. What's your experience in trying to relate what I think is a fairly simple but somehow really difficult concept for people to wrap their heads around?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is a familiar experience, actually. What ends up happening a lot is people get locked into this kind of debate around peak oil, and it becomes very polarized, and it's all about, well, the peak oilers once predicted that, you know, we would have exponentially increasing oil prices. That didn't happen. Oil is now cheap, so actually it's all fine. And then I tried to bring them back to the concept of energy return on investment, which is something that you've been speaking about for many years, which for me actually is something which cuts through a lot of the kind of like the polarity in the debate, the needless polarity, in the sense that, you know, we all know we're not actually physically running out of oil, but we're running out of high quality oil. And the costs of production are increasing and all of that. So it's interesting to see how people react to that, because on the one hand, there is a kind of like, you know, some of my readers will be like, they're already familiar with some of the ideas. And when they engage with this sort of analysis, which focuses more on global net energy and the way that global net energy is declining, in terms of the value of energy that we're able to produce now from the fossil fuel system, you know, it is basically going down. They kind of like, there's almost like there are some people who just have a sense of complete disbelief, mm-hmm. and they revert to this general technological optimism, which isn't really founded in anything in particular. It's just, well, we will solve this problem. We've solved all the problems in the past, so we'll solve this one. It's fine. And then I think the other thing that I've seen happening, which is slightly more dangerous though, is what's happening from the kind of more liberal, progressive people who we may actually feel that we share an understanding that climate change is a reality. We understand that there is a real biophysical crisis going on, but they will say that, well, renewable energies are increasing exponentially, and that's going to solve the problem. It's all going to be fine. And that's I think where you get this. That's where it kind of begins to break down. You know, where that the gravity of the kind of upward of the decline curve that we're seeing, and the fact that we haven't really got a kind of a plan or a strategy for a viable shift. And of course, there are shifts taking place. There's a lot of exciting things happening. There are exponential technological improvements taking place, but are they producing energy in the same way that we are familiar with under fossil fuels? No, it's not happening. It's a very different system. And I think that is something which is really, it comes as a shock to a lot of people. And a lot of people who've been engaging with my recent work, which of the last couple of months or so, I've been writing a lot about global net energy decline and EROI and stuff like that. I've noticed that it really does actually hit people. When people finally do engage with the issue, they do kind of really wonder, like, whoa, well, what does this mean? This is really, really a difficult issue.
Well, it's a absolutely paralyzing issue if you really understand it. So let's, you know, here's some of the data we've got recently. First off, there's a huge disinformation campaign, which I think is rooted more in beliefs and hope and optimism than it is in hard science. So one of the things that I struggle with, Nafees, every year is somewhere around year end, call it around, you know, the holidays. There's a flood of articles that come out that say, oh, look at the explosive growth in renewables this year. You know, Costa Rica powered 100% of itself with, you know, renewables. And I have to chip away at that and say, no. There were times when Costa Rica delivered 100% of its electricity, but that's not power. That's a portion of the power story. And there's all this sort of unpacking, and there's constant confusion thrown out there, including, you know, one, here's one I have to debunk every time I talk, but America's energy independent now. Like, no, right? That's if we put all the BTUs in one box and then count them as if they're the same, but oil's actually fundamentally different from coal. That level of detail is not really that difficult for me to talk about, but the confusion out there and how easily that confusion spreads speaks more, I think, to the idea that people want to believe that we're clever, we can solve this, and there's not a big predicament coming. in what you're talking about and what I try to talk about as well is this idea that no, once you get down one layer in complexity and you understand that it's the net energy that we run society on, not the total, but the net. Somehow I feel like there's almost an industry of confusion out there who's working very hard to keep this as muddy as possible. Or else, how do we explain the perpetual level of confusion? Are these just untrained journalists, or is the American Petroleum Institute actively putting out, you know, collateral packages for people to reprint? What's happening here? Why are we this confused still, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really good question, because there's a number of things which are going on. I think on the one hand, there is this problem, which I think you and I have addressed it in different ways. In our recent careers in dealing with these issues, which is that we have seen systemic thinking isn't really happening in a fundamental way in any of our institutions. We have, to some extent, it's to do with the nature of science as it's developed, you know, because science has kind of developed in this way of, you know, we try to dig deeper into things in order to understand how they work. So we look closer and closer and closer at how things work. And what that means is you inevitably end up in disciplinary silos. You know, you've got your economists, you've got your chemists, you've got your physicists. And it's definitely worked in the sense that it has produced real knowledge. But it's also meant that in terms of understanding how all those different areas are fundamentally interconnected, we simply don't have frameworks to actually see how they do connect. And that's something which I think we're seeing it as civilizationally. We don't have a civilizational framework grounded in a knowledge framework to make sense of the interconnections, which is why when you do say something like everything is interconnected, it sounds so radical and revolutionary, and also kind of obvious when you think about it. And I think that's why it's such a powerful thing to tell people and so provocative, because it's so within our cultures, within our institutions, we don't have frameworks to think in that way. So to some extent, you've got that kind of ground base where systemic, holistic thinking, and obviously not just thinking, but all forms of approach to knowledge, we haven't created frameworks to do that because we haven't felt the need to do it. And that has allowed all sorts of other interests to kind of come to the fore. So, you know, it's interesting you mentioned, for example, you know, the lobby groups. And this is what we're now faced with. We have this reality that there is an existing energy system which is dominated by fossil fuel interests. And they have a vested interest in kind of myopically keeping the show going for their own narrow vested interests. And of course, you know, it's you know, let's not do injustice to that. I mean, there are people in the fossil fuel industries who are seeing what's happening, who maybe want to change things, who maybe want to even change the way their industry works, even make it cleaner. But at the end of the day, even if we look at this systemically, we don't need to demonize anybody. We can see that this is a systemic problem. And when you're in an industry and this is how it works, it makes sense for you to do what you're doing. It makes sense for the fossil fuel industries to maximize their profit to try and drive out any other competitor. It just makes sense within the current system to do that. It's not an evil thing. It's just what makes sense. And that's partly why we can see all of this money which has gone into muddy the waters. It's why, you know, a company like ExxonMobil, well, in its past, Exxon, we know now, you know, in the 70s, they funded some of the earliest climate science. They knew climate change was real, but they made it a business decision because at some point someone up there realized that this was a threat to Exxon as it currently is structured, or as even it was structured then. And they thought, well, this is going to be mean. If we acknowledge this, it will mean the end of Exxon as we know it, so we won't acknowledge it. And so they did the opposite. So there's all of that going on. And I think at the same time, you've got the reality, which is that journalists are not really trained to deal with these issues, and it's kind of got worse. I mean, there was a time when, you know, say maybe 10, 20 years ago, when there was more of an appetite for you know, kind of like kind of more in-depth long kind of understanding of certain types of issues about oil and climate and all the rest of it. We're now moving into an age where social media has transformed the way in which the media system works, and is endangering even kind of the existing structures in the media. You know, and there's all sorts of these disruptive shifts taking place across different industries, which are all actually interconnected. But one of the things that is emerging is that it's making the lives of journalists more difficult. It's making it more difficult for media companies to reach out to millennials. So there's been this real kind of shift within the media. They don't know what they should be producing, and that's kind of allowed more polarization to take place, I think, in the debate about these issues. When people are talking about these issues in the mainstream media, it becomes very polarized. You've got vested interests trying to put out what they want to say, and then you've got people trying to counter it, and then you have people coalescing into these bubbles of discourse. And no one's talking to each other across those bubbles and having like a generated dialogue. And I think in the age of Trump, it seems to me that in the last few years into the age of Trump, I've felt, and I wonder if your listeners also would agree with this, that there has been a kind of tangible acceleration in the levels of informational confusion and polarization that are out there. And it's got a lot worse. And one of the arguments that I make in my book, Failing States, Collapsing Systems, is related to looking at the role of information in evolutionary adaptations in complex adaptive systems. And one of those simple things is that for an organism to adapt, it has to be able to process information from its environment in the right way through genetic modifications and so on and so forth. If it can't do that, then you know it will regress and it will eventually die. And it seems to me when we take that parallel and apply it on a civilizational basis to what we're facing now, I do think that there is enough grounds to think to suspect that we are really on the threshold of a systemic kind of phase shift where the information levels are so kind of fraught, and what that tells us is that basically our information architecture as a civilization is just not coping. It's not coping with the huge volumes of information that are being generated. We're not processing it in a way that produces meaningful, actionable knowledge for the stakeholders of this civilization, for the people that matter, for communities, and even actually for businesses, for companies, all of the kind of the agencies that kind of matter and make decisions and are affected are not being well served anymore by the existing information architectures that we do have. Instead, everything's becoming much more confusing, much more difficult to make sense of what's going on. And I think that is a major signifier of where we are actually as a civilization right now.
I absolutely agree. And for me, it wants both overly complex and actually very simple. So the overly complex part to me is that we are flooded with information now, and it's well beyond our capability as individuals to process, but individuals have a higher processing capacity than collections of individuals. So, you know, the apocryphal committee, you know, can deal with a lot less decision-making complexity than an individual can. It's just the nature of humans. And so here we are at this really important time in human history. So one of the ways, Nafees, that I talk to audiences, I say, look, I'm going to give you some frightening data, but I'm also going to tell you that this is actually I'm really glad to be alive now because this is astonishing. Humans have an opportunity here to transition and grow up. The human development metaphor would be we're adolescents. We've just come out of this period of believing we're immortal, that we can survive anything, that we can solve any problem. And we're now confronting lots of hard data that says, no, you actually have to make an income. You have a budget. Time to grow up. You're not going to live forever. So we're at this stage of development as a species. And I think it's an open question as to whether or not we manage or navigate this transition to adulthood. And so here's, you know, this is hugely complex. How do you, you know, we're going from 7.4 to 9 billion people and energy's running out, all this crazy stuff. And here's the simple stuff, though, that this is where I can bring it back and connect with audiences. I'll say, hey, in the United States, 3 weeks ago, I guess 4 weeks ago now, we just put the rusty-patched bumblebee on the endangered species list. You know, so I'm talking to these guys at NASA, right? And they're like scratching their heads like, why should I care? I said, well, what if I brought a doofus into the space station and he started removing chips from the oxygen generating boards? You know, how would you feel? And they'd be like, oh, no, don't do that. I'm like, well, you can't remove a sentinel species like the bumblebee, which does something called vibrational pollination. It's very different. You can't just grow more honeybees because they pollinate differently. And there's a whole host of things that depend on the bumblebee. And if the bumblebee goes away, they all go away. And, you know, our ability to predict what happens next is zero. But we can probably say that yanking a sentinel species out is a bad idea, or phytoplankton down 40% in the oceans, that there are these flashing red warning signs saying we're taking the only space station we've got. And I'm just going to put a little asterisk here and note that all you people out there who think we're going to Mars is some sort of a solution, have fun. You know, join a little group. You'll never find me joining you in that little party, because that is a fantasy. As a double aside, if you want to go live on Mars, there is a valley in Antarctica, which is just as cold and just as rainless. Go spend a couple weeks there. Come back. Tell me how excited you are to spend the rest of your life on Mars with other people. So with that said, there are these warning signs that say a mature adult species would throw up its hands in a timeout sign and say, hey, whoa, we got to fix this right away. We can't lose the bumblebee. What's going on? But what happened with that information, Nafees, is it barely made it into the news. It was on National Geographic. I found it in a couple of newspapers, and it was on Twitter for a day, and it's gone. But meanwhile, I think people connect with the dread of, there's something like really dreadful about that information. It's gnawing deep down. And I think this is where the millennials are coming into this story for me, because increasingly I talk with younger people and they express it to me like this. They say, Chris, I'm paraphrasing wildly, but they say the narrative is broken. The story we're organizing ourselves around doesn't work. But the keepers, you know, the Donald Trumps and the Hillary Clintons and the Janet Yellens and the Mario Draghi's are all saying, we are just going to perpetuate the status quo at every possible expense and risk. And we know that's not a good idea anymore. We're in that uncomfortable, awkward period where the old story is broken and we don't know what the new story is. And my concern is that the longer we perpetuate the old story, the worse the possible solutions become in the future, and the narrower our choices of things we get to do. Because once you lose the bumblebee, your choices now include hand pollinating tomatoes and melons and other things that require them, or losing them to time. I feel like really, instead of like, as much as this is a complex informational story, that's the complexity of it. The simple part is that we're humans, narratives and stories shape our lives. Our cultural narrative is broken. How do we begin going about rewriting and implementing a new narrative that comports with the realities?
I mean, that's the question of the century, right?
Yep.
I mean, this is really something that I think all of us who are tracking these issues there's definitely been a convergence, I think, amongst people who are seeing the connect the dots and the importance of the connect the dots approach, and actually connecting those dots and seeing where it's taking us. There is a convergence in that recognition that this really does require a fundamental reconfiguration of how we see ourselves as a species, and our place really, you know, on the planet, and what it's all about. You know, it really strikes at the heart of who we are, and what life means to us. And I think what's exciting, in a way, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned, there is this interesting dynamic between the dread of what is going on and the fear, which are completely rational responses, actually, to the uncertainty that we're facing, but also the awesomeness of the opportunity that is present. And as you said, that actually, you know, there are people who kind of will bat different sides. Some people will be more pessimistic. Some people will be more optimistic. And I'm like you. I kind of feel that really it's an open question. We don't know. I mean, it could be that we really don't know. Maybe our fate is sealed and we don't know that either. but I think at this point, there's so much going on that unless you kind of position yourself to be ready to say, well, I'm going to be part of building what is possible for humanity, there's kind of no point. I mean, if you're going to be a pessimist and you're just going to be like, well, we're all going to die and everything's going to be shit, well, fine. That's what you think, but, you know, that's not going to add anything. And if it's true, well, there's nothing wrong with me saying, well, actually, I'm going to stare into the face of the abyss, but I'm going to do it smiling and laughing and trying to see, well, let's see how we can get through this. And let's see what the light at the end of the tunnel looks like. Because what's the most fascinating thing for me really is how so much of what we take for granted becomes questionable as a result of this breakdown that we're seeing. So when we begin questioning the exponential growth model, when we begin questioning the value system of basically this kind of endless material production and consumption, and then we begin questioning this idea of ourselves as being, well, are we, you know, this whole paradigm that we're just these disconnected material units, and our self-interest is what is the issue. When we begin to see that all of that is actually, in a way, complicit in this breakdown, and it served the purpose that it served. You know, it's not that it hasn't produced amazing knowledge of our environment, of our place in the universe. It's not that there hasn't been a huge amount of amazing technological developments like the internet, which has enabled people to be interconnected in ways that they never were able to before, and in a way has paved the way for us to be able to think globally in a way that, you know, centuries ago would never have happened. So it's not that everything about this paradigm is bad. It's just that it seems to have very clearly outlasted its usefulness and is now it's now fundamentally responsible for escalating this kind of biophysical rupture that we see happening and manifesting in so many different ways. And what that tells me is that in terms of where we go, and I think you really kind of captured this where you said that we have to grow up, you know, as a species. It's about growing up. It is very much, it is an evolutionary moment, and we're looking at a point now when we apply systems theory to this, when we apply our knowledge of complex adaptive systems and the history of evolution, it does seem to me that it's absolutely clear, really, that we are at an unprecedented moment, which is very unique, where for the first time in human history, we are standing at a point where we need to basically undergo some sort of fundamental systemic adaptation. And exactly what that looks like, we are still trying to work out, but what is very clear is what it doesn't look like. It doesn't look like seeing each other as separate material entities that just fend for ourselves and produce and consume to an endless degree. It looks quite different. And what's interesting is that the ideas and the values and the ethos of that different approach has been percolating in different civilizations in different ways. You know, I mean, there is evidence from indigenous civilizations, from tribal societies, and even from projects that are now being seeded here and now in our current in our current context, where people are trying different things. So I think we are at a moment where we're rewriting that story and making a new story of what it means to be human is actually really, really important. And it's particularly important because when people do look at this stuff with kind of fresh eyes, it's very easy to be overwhelmed by this sense of powerlessness. And that's kind of what's happening now with the rise of Trump and everything else. There is this sense of, whoa, what's going on? It's absolutely crazy. It's getting worse. And I think obviously in many ways it is going to get worse before it gets better. But I think as even what's happening now, such as the rise of Trump and everything, I mean, all of this really is symptomatic of the deeper crisis that is at play. And so I think that's the question that we will need to be able to ask ourselves, is to what extent can I make myself useful to that imperative going forward of building and planting seeds for what comes after this moment?
Absolutely, Nafiz. I'm really glad you brought this up because, you know, when people first encounter the data, which they already know, by the way, I just connect dots and people already know this. Like, you know, here's the most common response I get from people. They say, "You freaked me out and you didn't tell me anything I didn't already know," on some level, right? It's just people haven't taken the time sometimes or didn't want to assemble the dots and see them clearly. So that first response is sphincter tightening, gut wrenching, like, ah, darn it, you know, kind of moment. But the opportunity here, which I'm glad you brought up, is to think about what's actually possible. Because I hate to put it this way, but all the data, at least from my country, but I suspect other countries can share this, is that it's really actually never been easier to be a human in like human history, you know, really. I mean, in terms of attending to the basics of bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, getting fed, sheltered, clothed, all of that stuff, even at minimum wage, you can do this pretty easily. People are living really high on the hog, 2,500 square foot homes here in the United States, you know, all of that. And still, I would have to say that for most people, they would tell you on a personal basis something close to life sucks. You know, there's something soul destroying about the way we've organized all this. It's very cost effective. It's good for consumers. You have access to all these material goods. They trigger our dopamine receptors. They feel good brief, fleetingly, but inside, this is just not fulfilling. It's not authentic. It's not all of these things that people, I think, all through history have always strove for, right? In some way, shape, or form. You can read Rumi poems that speak to the condition today. So there is an opportunity to peel it back and say, geez, you know, we could fix a few things here. We're the most over-medicated, the most overweight, the most, you know, practically most imprisoned, et cetera, and so forth. In 2010, suicides overtook car accidents as the leading cause of non-natural death, and opioid overdoses are now catching up to that. It's just astonishing that just those statistics say these are unhappy people, right? We need to numb ourselves out, but from what? You know, and I think from what is that the story we're trying to live into is life destroying, not just for ourselves individually, but larger. And so the opportunity here is to reconnect with, dare I say, things that are sacred, things that are beautiful, things that are all of these sort of feminine attributes, I would say, that we lost somewhere in this large sweep of history. We went down this path for a long time, and it was beautiful and wonderful and cost effective and made lots of profits. But on the other side, it's really hasn't been serving us as humans who are coming here to have an experience, I guess, while we're alive, of saying, you know, how can I be more connected, more alive, and really fulfill something that's meaningful here and leave behind a world that's worth inheriting at the same time? That's really what's up for grabs here. To me, that's exciting. To me, it's exciting. I am somebody who, in my own life, I sleep really well. I'm healthier than I was 10 years ago. I love the garden that I'm growing, which is not just for me and my family, but it's for the birds and the bees and other critters out there. That to me, this was an opportunity in this data. The opportunity embedded in this for me was to say, oh, how do I want to live my life? And how do I want to put things together? Which was actually one of the greatest gifts in the story was waking up from the world that I was fully immersed in, PhD, MBA, corporate life, all of that, boat in the slip, doing that. But I honestly, Nafiz, I was unhappy in that story because I wasn't taking control. I was living into somebody else's story, not mine. So this isn't a plea for us to all become hyper-individualists, you know, live our own way. No, this is to become more connected and to become more immersed in this project of life. And this to me is, I think, where if I was going to insert something, I think it was an extraordinary thing at the time of the Constitution was written. They borrowed some stuff from the Iroquois Nation and wrote, "All men are created equal," right? That was a big statement for the time. They didn't really mean it. Took a few hundred years to actually grow into that a little bit further. If I was going to replace that line, it would be now, "All life is created and has a purpose," or something like that. that's our next transition. We might write those words and take 200 more years to grow into it, but I feel like that's where we are. We're at a critical turning point for humanity. We either get the base story right or we don't. But that to me has meaning, and we want meaning in our lives. And the number of people who have jobs, this is like, so short plug for people listening, our annual weekend seminar at Rowe, Massachusetts, coming up April 6th to 9th. One of the key topics that we talk about over those three and a half days is people show up and they say, I feel like I'm leading two lives. The life that I've sort of fell into and the one I want to be leading. And there's a gap between those. And that in many cases, people report that their jobs, their existence, who they are to show up in this world is not who they want to be. And they know it's not who they should be, given the data that you surface and that I surface and other people do. So to me, that's the energy in this story, is to just wave a flag and say, hey, how would you like to have a life that's actually got meaning associated with it? And, you know, not saying this is all going to be rainbows and unicorns, but there's clearly some tough sledding ahead. But at least it'll have a purpose that goes beyond, hey, I helped Walmart make an extra penny this quarter, or whatever your job happens to be. Right? Does that resonate at all for you?
Absolutely. Very much so. I think this is, I mean, this really is, this. I mean, I think we're very much aligned in terms of where we're seeing. I mean, this for me is almost what the task of the journalist is today, which I think is really missing from what journalists are doing. And it's something that I have tried to, and it's why I have a crowdfund to support me to do investigative work, which is not, which I know will not get commissioned anywhere else. I mean, if you look at the recent pieces that I've done, they would just, no one would commission them. And I know I write for Vice, and they're really good to some extent on certain issues. They've given me a really great platform. But when it comes to really connecting dots, it's just not going to happen. And I think that's kind of like a real challenge, is to develop kind of new institutions and mechanisms that will allow us to begin to communicate this on a much wider level. And also, I think it's really critical for people to be able to think about how they can actually take that information and utilize it within their own context, whether it's going to be in your family or in your community. I think the real big question is, how can I actually take this information and use it to actually change my life and my paradigm and really make a break with the old paradigm? Because I think the more and more people that are able to do that, the more we will be able to shift to something which is generative. I mean, if we don't do, I mean, this is kind of like, what's the problem? We're, at the moment, if you look at the way that responses are taking place now, everything is very, it's still kind of stuck within the cycles of the system. So, for example, even with what's happening with Donald Trump and all the crazy executive orders that he's put through and all the rest of it, the response to that has been, I mean, I'm totally supportive of it, of you know, the response has been the resistance. You know, it's been let's flood the streets, let's march, let's do this, let's resist, let's not take our phones to the, you know, on international flights and all that stuff. But the thing is that none of that actually contributes to the change, to the systemic change that we need. In fact, really, we're so preoccupied with looking at the symptom of the problem, which is, you know, this gigantic orange face in our TV screens, and that we're just literally reacting to that, and we get locked into a cycle of, and what happens is, when we look at case studies of how this has happened in other places in the world, places where there are less resources, worse institutions, where people don't have, you know, so many square feet to live and all the rest of it, like Syria, for example, this is one of the themes that come up in my new book. If you look at somewhere like Syria, where we see the convergence of these crises taking place, you know, you've got climate change ravaging the lives of farmers because of the drought, and then these farmers kind of going into the coastal cities, you know, and they're predominantly Sunni, going into these coastal cities dominated by Bashar al-Assad's clan, the Alawites, and they're going into the, and so now you've got these economic tensions increasing over like a decade. You compound that with Syria's peak in conventional oil production in 96. You know, and their state revenues began to hemorrhage after about 10 years or so. There was no planning for this, no understanding of what was going on. You know, and Bashar al-Assad is, you know, you would say that at the end of the day, he's not exactly going to look at these things and be like, well, let me now explore alternative institutions. Right. Or, you know, I mean, that's like, it's not, I mean, it's bad late. Enough here. It's difficult enough here, right? But over there, it's like, well, let me just get the guns out, right? People are getting angry. Let me get the guns out. So what happened is, you know, we saw this happen, break out with the Arab Spring, and you know, it got to a point where people couldn't afford bread, you know, but that systemic context of how climate, the food crisis, the local water crisis kind of hit the geopolitics and it hit the human system. And so I've got this, I've created these categories where you've got earth system disruption and human system destabilization. And one of the things I keep trying to explain to people is that when, you know, so when people were hitting the streets in Syria, and they, you know, it was, you know, totally understandable what they were doing. But what really ended up happening is it contributed to human system destabilization because people were not addressing the systemic causes. And I'm not saying that necessarily, I don't think they were doing anything wrong. They weren't necessarily equipped to deal with the systemic causes and maybe still aren't. I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, but the reality is we just look at it and stand back in hindsight. We can see how, you know, the geopolitics of that internationally and the domestic politics of it just went, you know, everybody went in with their interests, you know, the Russians, the Iranians, the Americans, the Saudis, the Gulf states, blah, 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 Turkey, everyone going in there. And, you know, what's happened as a result of that is that Syria is worse off. You know, we've had an ongoing civil war, which has ravaged the lives of people. Infrastructure has been completely destroyed. And I think what I've tried to do is try to connect, and now because the if you look at the way the main, and this is what really comes down to the myopia of the mainstream media and our information architectures today, which is we look at what's happening in Syria and all we see is it's either it's the evil rebels or it's the evil Bashar al-Assad or it's the evil Russians or it's the evil Americans. Someone is evil and someone's doing something wrong, and that's what's happening and that's it. What we're not seeing is that this is a state failure that was triggered by a fundamental systemic breakdown, a breakdown which is on its way to, you know, it's on its way to the United States, it's on its way to Western Europe. It may take time to get here, but it is coming if we don't do anything about it. And I think that's kind of like when we take that framework and we look at what's happening with Trump or, you know, things which, you know, across the pond, you know, with Brexit. And kind of the potential breakup of Europe and things like that. Again, a lot of these things happening on the surface, it's really important that we begin to see what's happening beneath the surface and see them systemically. And when we want to respond to them, that we respond in a way which is generative. So there is a huge opportunity here again. You know, like it's almost like people around the world are waking up because of Trump. Like they're suddenly waking up that, wait a minute, something is deeply wrong. You know, things are going really, really crazy. There's an insane person in the White House who is more insane than anything we've ever had. I mean, previously we've had bad people in the White House. Now we've got an insane bad person in the White House. What's going on? There is this sense of awakening, but people still don't really know where to go with it. They're not sure what things mean. So I think more than ever, there is a real importance in kind of giving people the conceptual tools to see how dots are connected. That's like really, really critical that people are able to develop their own internal kind of information architecture to do that. And then also to be able to translate that into a generative response, which isn't just, which I would say, yeah, go and protest, you know, go out on the street or do something which is a sense of resistance, but also use that resistance to build something new, which goes beyond the existing paradigm. I think that's at the moment, We don't see much discussion about this in civil society. You know, we don't see much discussion, you know, amongst our civil liberties organizations or within the Black Lives Matter movement or even amongst environmentalists who are just talking about well, we just need to have clean energy. We just need to have clean energy. There is this, again, this very, very narrow focus. And what we need to do is somehow move that discourse into something which says, can we stop just resisting within the system and look to how we can build a new system? Because the old system is basically dying.
I completely agree. And I for one, think that Trump is a great thing at this point. And he's a symptom, not a cause. He's a great thing at this time because he's just making it plainly, grotesquely transparent what's happening. Whereas I think under Obama, because he was suave, he was smooth. Let's be clear. You know, Obama didn't put any bankers in jail. He funded plenty of bombs, drone strikes, Guantanamo, you know, no reining in of the neonicotinoid pesticide use, on and on and on and on and on. But people were okay with that because he at least gave the appearance of being reasonable. Trump is plainly unreasonable to a lot of people. And now all of a sudden they have energy saying, ugh, yeah, this stuff he's doing is awful. Like it was just as awful under the old guy as the new guy, but I'm glad we're talking about it. But you're right. It only matters if we can then go beyond the simple sort of knee-jerk reaction, which says, oh my gosh, if we could just get Trump out and say, install Hillary, oh, then I can go back to sleep, because we can't go back to sleep. I mean, Trump is like he's a bucket of ice water. He's saying, wake up. But honestly, he didn't arise again out of a vacuum. There was 40 or 50 years of Democratic and Republican failures that sort of led to this moment. So here we are, right? I think to have the lessons of that's really, really critical. So, again, I want to direct people to patreon.com/Nafiz. He obviously needs support to do things that otherwise are not supported by the media at this point. Nobody wants to pay for this kind of dot connecting because it's so uncomfortable, but it's so necessary. So that's patreon.com/Nafiz. We're going to link to that as well. In the time we have left, because again, and I knew we were going to run out of time, we've been talking fairly big picture. I want to, if we could, in the last few minutes, I just want to narrow this down and talk about my favorite subject, which is that the last 3 years of oil discoveries, the last two in particular, worst since the 50s, were replacing less than 10% of the oil was discovered last year than was burned. And to anybody who understands the oil business, you have to find it before you can pump it. One of my mantras with people has been, the trillion plus dollars of investments that were not made over the last 3 years are going to bite us probably in the next 3 or 4 years. What's your view on this?
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. That, I mean, what we've seen over the last few years is that the rate of discoveries has massively declined. We've seen that because of the challenges that the industry is facing in terms of its profitability and the oil price slump, that there's just not been an appetite to increase investment to kind of ramp up discoveries. And even where there has been huge amount, you know, when there were huge investments, discoveries were still declining. And we appear to be hitting this point. And I mean, it's interesting. In one of my pieces, I kind of counterposed two oil industry type perspectives. One was an analysis by HSBC, which basically was completely misinterpreted in the media. I mean, they acknowledged that they recognized that HSBC was saying there was a supply problem coming down the line. But for the most part, there wasn't really an understanding of how bad the supply problem is that HSBC warns about. And on the other hand, there's a report from BP, which, you know, their kind of annual energy outlook, which kind of tries to say the opposite, that discoveries have been increasing. And actually, this is a really interesting example of the sleight of hand that goes on within the industry, because the reality is that the number of, you actually look at the number of actual discoveries, everyone knows they've been declining. I mean, that's not like some controversy, it's just like a known fact across the industry. But then you've got this BP report coming out, and what they've done, they did this really interesting thing where they were like, well, actually, if you look at they calculated the kind of reserve base of fossil fuels in general. And the way this is done is done, it's basically done on probabilities. So, you know, like there's like a 50% probability that there are a certain number of reserves in a certain area. And they have certain parameters for deciding how probable it is that those are going to be recoverable. And so they've been playing around with these figures. I mean, and the thing is that we know, you know, International Energy Agency has acknowledged that, you know, back in the day in the 70s, there was some kind of fudging of figures effectively. I mean, they didn't say it was fudging, but they did acknowledge that most of the major Middle East producers basically increased their reserves through this accounting mechanism by saying that, well, what we're going to do is, rather than using a 75% probability kind of measure to see whether these reserves are recoverable technically, we'll just reduce it to 50% so we can get more bang for our buck in terms of what we're putting down in our books. And that's literally what they did. And there's a number of studies which have actually looked at this, you know, major peer-reviewed studies within the, you know, in industry journals, like in kind of like energy, proper energy journals, and they've acknowledged that, you know, we've had a, this suggests that actual reserve estimates are being massively inflated. And what's extraordinary is last year I reported on a study that was done in Wiley Reviews of Energy, and which basically concluded that, I think it was 1.8 trillion global reserves had been overestimated by possibly as much as half. And the guy who wrote this is the editor of the Energy Journal, published by Elsevier, and he's like a former Shell chief economist. This guy is not like a pariah. I mean, this guy has been at the heart of the industry for decades. Now, BP put out their report, and they say, no, don't worry, we've actually got 2.6 trillion barrels worth. And that was like just a year later. Where did these come from? Because there's been no new discoveries. It's absolutely extraordinary. And you see what they've actually done is, they've literally just done again the same sleight of hand. And they even had the gall to map it on a graph and to say, well, actually, if you look year by year, these are the number of reserves that we've been adding to our global resource base. And so it looks like there's been an incremental increase in the reserves we've been finding, when actually it's been the exact opposite. So what I did, I actually just took the graph from the HSBC report, which showed discoveries hemorrhaging, and took BP's graph and just put them side by side and said, well, you know, you guys decide.
Yeah.
You guys just look at the facts, look at the data, you guys decide where we are. And it just sums it up. You can make your own informed choice. We don't need to be ideological about this, but Houston, we have a problem.
Yes, absolutely. And technically, if we took North Dakota and just dug down 10,000 feet and flipped the whole thing over like a flapjack, we could probably really increase the amount of oil we say we might get out of that, because we could crush every you know, chunk of the oil-bearing shales down there and get all the oil back up. We're going to get 10% out. And this is the thing that's hard to communicate to people, is they just say, well, look at all this shale oil that's coming out. I'm like, yeah, but in 1937, when they stuck a straw into the Ghawar and 30,000 barrels a day started flowing out of a single 6-inch pipe, and that pipe was going to flow for the next 70 years or more. That's very different from drilling down 10,000 feet, tipping it sideways, going another 10,000 feet, doing a 100-stage frack, getting maybe 800 barrels a day of initial production that's 85% gone in 3 years, and repeating that endlessly. Anybody who's flown over the shale states and looked out the window and seen the patchwork quilt of the effort involved has to understand that that is fundamentally a different proposition from the oil that we used to fund ourselves to get to this stage. And the degree to which people don't understand that is, I think, a shame. But second of all, I think the risk in this is that it is a huge mistake to assume that we are going to fund the continued exponential expansion of our credit markets at more than twice the rate of GDP growth, now three times in the last 5 years because GDP has been so low, and that we can just perpetuate that indefinitely without any sort of a difficult patch is just beyond fantasy. It's beyond delusional. It's insane at this point in time. So really, the central bankers at this point, to me, are no longer rational, reasonable people who deserve our polite attention. They are literally like the head priests and priestesses of an insane, delusional death cult, if I could put it that way, because they just don't understand the physical realities of our world. And that's the part I'm wondering, you know, summarize this up. I know we're getting to the end of our time. People need to understand that physical component of the world we live in, and that our economy is a subset of that, not the other way around, that Our high technology is actually an artifact or an emergent property of surplus energy, not the other way around. That these are really important assumptions that need to be either inverted or at least debated so that people can say, no, I reject that inversion and here's why. But we're not even yet having those debates. They're just starting. I know that you're doing the best that you can to bring that forward. I want to direct people again at this point to your book, Failing States, Collapsing Systems, The Biophysical Triggers of Political Violence. And if I was going to put another term on there, it might be financial violence, because this our whole exponential model has two states, right? Expanding or collapsing. That seems what 2008 taught me. So with that, again, one last time, patreon.com/Nafiz. I wish let's do this again, Nafiz, if we can, because I have 100 more questions for you. Obviously, we could carry this conversation on for a long time. So with that, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Chris. Really appreciate it. Lovely chatting to you. Really interesting.